Next is Class 3 of the Queen Kinti Seminar, given on January 8, 1993, at the Gidanagari Institute.
My Lord, I consider your Lordship to be eternal time, the supreme controller, without beginning and end, the all-pervasive one. In distributing your mercy, you are equal to everyone. The dissensions between living beings are due to social intercourse. So, after the section on how Krishna is especially inclined to those who are materially exhausted and gives special mercy to his devotees in danger, now Queen Kunti is again giving some definitions of the Supreme Personality of God, as she did in the very first verse, emphasizing his Aishwarya, his inconceivable greatness. So God is beyond matter, beyond understanding of the mind. This section, however, is called Bewildering Pastimes. So we're going to see how the bewildering part is that this absolute truth, who is inconceivable in so many ways, has pastimes which are bewildering. So there are four Sanskrit words here, which are, each one is a definition of God, or an expression of God's different aspects. Kalam, he's eternal time. So he is not, that means that he's not subject to time, past, present, and future, but he's in control of all time, and we're under that time, all the jivas. Ishanam, he's the Lord, he's the controller, supreme. Anadi Nitinam, he doesn't have any beginning or end. Vibhum, vibhum means great, or here it means all-pervading. Whenever you give a definition of God, one thing it does is make clear that only God is God, and no one else has these kind of qualities. All the jivas, they're under the kala, and it's a kala. It's a very deep word. It doesn't just mean time is passing, but it means destiny, control, God's control through time. This will be discussed in, no doubt, in Ramapada Swami's class about Bhishma Dev. He talks about how everything is under the influence of inconceivable time, and destiny, as destiny. So when we misuse our free will, then we come under kala. And that's expressed by Krishna in his all-pervading form. Now, in addition to those words, Krishna is described in the third lines, samam charantam sarvata. Everywhere he's equal. Samam means equal. He distributes his mercy everywhere equally. You are equal to everyone. The dissensions between living beings are due to social intercourse. Means God is not to blame for the different sufferings or fates and karmas. But this is due to the living entities and how they use or misuse their free will. They bring about disagreements among themselves. And however, as far as he's concerned, he's exchanging with everyone equally. That's also in Bhagavad Gita. Samoham sarva-bhuteshu name dvesho jinapina. I'm not envious of anyone. No one is an object like that of me. That's be taken up in the next verse also of Queen Kunti's prayers. And in Bhagavad Gita, yeyata mam papajyante tam sthitava bhajamyaham. As people approach me, I approach them equally. So in distributing your mercy, you are equal to everyone. At the end of this, of his lecture on this verse, Prabhupada says that we should try to understand scientifically, meaning in parampara, the science of God, Actually, the Western word theology means theo, Greek for God, ology, like any science, biology. But this is the science of God, and it's known by hearing in submissively in disciplic succession. So a prayer like this, full of the realization of Krishna, is something that we can take up. It's not only for Queen Kunti. Prabhupada makes this point that when Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, that's not just for Arjuna. He's not saying, only you, Arjuna, can understand this, but it's for everyone. And similarly, sarvam charantam sarvata, he distributes himself to everyone. So the more we can enter Queen Kunti's prayers by reciting them and hearing them, we can also understand Krishna's inconceivable qualities. There's that statement by Srila Jiva Goswami that unless you accept the inconceivable power, achinta shakti, that God has inconceivable power, then you cannot understand anything about him. But when that's accepted, then things start to become clear. This section builds up. This is like a prelude to it, for the next three verses. Any more? Any questions on this one? Yes.
As far as this point about the consensus between living beings and due to social intercourse,
yeah,
it seems to be discouraging social intercourse. And is that true if you avoid associating with people, or if you avoid dissension of
beings? I think it's meant to be like quite technical language. Social intercourse, meaning interchanges, when living beings, when they come in contact with each other, that's what causes their problems. Yeah, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't come in contact with each other, but it's explaining the cause of their dissensions. One purpose is to clear the charge that the dissensions are due to Krishna being envious towards one set of people or something like that. No, it doesn't mean, but we should have intercourse with Krishna in the center. That should be the way we have social exchange. Otherwise, any attempts at social exchange without Krishna in the center bring so much strife. Prabhupada talks about that, about how brotherhood, fraternity, is very desired in human society, but without the center of Krishna, then somebody's concept of, he described it like throwing different pebbles in different places in a pond, and the concentric circles, they go out and they clash each other. Because my idea of brotherhood has a different center than your idea. And so we cannot exchange very peacefully unless we have Krishna in the center. It's not an invitation that each person should be a completely separate unit and stay away from everybody else. That's not possible.
They couldn't find that commonality.
They
actually concluded with
some
statement of purpose. They couldn't include the word God.
Right? Like the United Nations. You'd expect they would have been able to come up with God.
Mm.
Someone else? Okay, let's move on. We'll chant together, 29. Naveda kaschid bhagavam shikirshitam tavehamanasya nirnam vidambanam nanasya kaschid dayato sikarhichid dvesyascha chasmin vishame matir nirnam. O Lord, no one can understand your transcendental pastimes, which appear to be human and so are misleading. You have no specific object of favor, nor do you have any object of envy. People only imagine that you are partial. So the second half of the verse is like an expansion of what we just studied, that Krishna is impartial, that Krishna is not impartial. Krishna is impartial. Mm-hmm. So those definitions that Krishna is Kala, he's the Lord, he's Vibhu, etc., these place him far beyond the human beings. But when he comes in his incarnation, he comes as a person, as Krishna or Rama and so on. So this is the cause of the apparent misleading or bewildering nature. How can such an inconceivable being have human pastimes? This is misleading. So Prabhupada, in his lecture, he talks about different relations that jivas have with the Lord, and he mentions three. One is that they're completely against him. Other, that they approach him, but for favors that they want. And then the actual devotees, who have an unalloyed service attitude without seeking any reward from Krishna. And so this is Krishna's impartiality, that he approaches, he responds to each one of those as they approach him. Thus his mercy is equally distributed, as in the verse 27. I mean 28. Samam charantam sarvatam. Now, this will be discussed. The rest of the next two verses also will especially focus on the misleading nature of the pastimes. But it's taken up here also. And part of the puzzle then is why does he come here? And the day, let's see, that's tomorrow. Yeah, the class will be just on different opinions as to why he came. But that's taken up here also. And Prabhupada quickly goes to the heart of the matter and says why Krishna appears. I thought this is a nice excerpt on this too. The real reason for Krishna's appearance, so no one should be bewildered about that. Just a minute, see if I can, if there's any introduction to that needed. No, okay.
So here Kunti Devi is describing that your appearance in this material world is not misleading, bewildering. We are thinking that Krishna has got some mission, some purpose, therefore he has appeared. No, it is his pastime. It is pastime. Just like sometimes the governor goes to inspect the prison house. He has no business to go to the prison house. He is getting report from the superintendent. He doesn't. Still, sometimes he comes. Let me see how they are doing.
Then he goes on to say in that exact section that if the prisoners think the governor has come, therefore he's a prisoner, that they're rascaldom, and it's certainly a misconception. So they get bewildered. And the word here, idambanam. Where is that? Idambanam. It's twice it occurs. I think it occurs before that too. Yeah, we're on 29. Vidambanam, second line. Tave hamanasya nirnam vidambanam. No one can understand the Lord's real purpose. But Prabhupada just gave it to us. Let me go and see. He wants to go. He has no a need to come, such as to kill demons. But he wants to come. In his lecture, he explores this some more and says, for example, it is said that Krishna comes to deliver the sadhu, paritranaya sadhanam vinishaya chaduskritam. But the sadhu is already delivered. That's another contradiction. The person who's already delivered, he doesn't need to be delivered. But because the inner desire of the sadhu is he wants to see Krishna, and Krishna's desire is to fulfill that reciprocation, so he comes to meet with the devotees and to satisfy their desires. So you have no specific object of favor, nor do you have any object of envy. Somebody might think he's coming for that reason, for these reasons. As for having objects of favor, Prabhupada says that when he comes and he asks devotees to serve him, that's not out of his need that he needs to pick up some servants. Krishna has innumerable servants, but it is for our benefit that he does that. And as for objects of envy, Krishna is not envious at all. And any demon that he kills is not out of envy or maliciousness. An example is that they get liberated, like Putana wanted to kill Krishna and took the method of killing the baby by spreading the nipple of her breast with poison. And Krishna killed her in return. But he took the bright side and said, she came as my mother, like a nurse, so I will give her a place in the next life as my mother. Citing that example, Uddhava says in a prayer, since Krishna behaved like that towards the inimical Putana, who can be a better, more compassionate Supreme Personality of Godhead? I worship him. And then he gives another example, though, of misleading pastime, as Krishna is rescuing the 16,000 queens that were captured by Bhaumasura. And he tells the story in detail, how the girls were kidnapped, and after Krishna rescued them, they said that they couldn't go home, because in Vedic society, if a girl stays out even one night, no one will marry her. So then he said, what do you want? And they said, we want that you should marry us. And Krishna married them and expanded himself in 16,108 forms. So, or 16,000. So someone will hear this pastime of the Lord, who is advertised as the Lord beyond modes, all time, etc. And they said, this sounds like he's a lusty man, or it's a completely made up story. So it's bewildering. When he was lecturing on this, I don't have it as an excerpt, but Prabhupada, he said that they say he's lusty. And he said, even if he is lusty, he's unlimitedly lusty. It's a great force. Krishna, because who could? This is also God, that he could marry 16,000 wives. It's not even in the category of what we consider lust. It's just beyond anything inconceivable. I've told how in my own case, when I first heard Prabhupada explain this, I was bewildered to the point that you become doubtful. So I raised my hand in the storefront and said that I'm trying to. And what I was saying, on exact words, but what I was saying is, I was making some nice progress when you're teaching Bhagavad Gita chapters about Krishna, the teacher of Bhagavad Gita. But how can I, and others like me, how can we accept this? That the same Krishna married 16,000 wives. I can't understand this. And Prabhupada said, you cannot understand. Even the greatest scholar cannot understand. So they're bewildering pastimes. I have a nice explanation in the next verse about how to not be bewildered, and more about the nature of the bewildering pastimes. But are there any questions about this verse? Yeah.
The question is then how come his descent is so minutely like predicted in scripture?
Krishna is well organized. He's not like some impulsive person who says, "Let me go," and nothing is prepared. everyone is inconvenienced by his impulsive, disorganized visit. Oh, we didn't know you were coming. His driver doesn't have the car ready, and they don't bring any money for the road. So Krishna is spontaneous, but he does everything pukka when he comes. It's right on. And whose schedule is it? It's not that I... No, oh, now I have to go. It's time for the incarnation. But it's his schedule that I shall come at this time, then I shall come at that time. I'm just, as you know, speaking, but at least it shouldn't be any doubt that he's enforced by this, by the schedule of incarnations. It's just another attempt to make some human imposition. That if a person, you would say, if a person was spontaneous and say, let's go, I want to go to the material world, that there wouldn't be a schedule long in advance that he was going to do that. But that is Krishna. Yes?
Why can somebody like this at near 15,000?
Because they would say that nobody could do that. It's not possible. What man, sometimes some men have more than one wife, some king or something, maybe two wives, 10 wives, but who could have 16,000 wives? Who could be so rich? And who could go and visit them? And then you hear, yes, well, Krishna not only visited them, but he stayed with each one. And then they say, oh, that must be made up. Nobody could do that. So that's because Krishna does things so great, then people can't believe. They just have a tiny idea of what somebody could do. Yes?
The devotee is not a merchant, and serving the Lord just in exchange for some good, like most people pay just for their needs to be fulfilled. But isn't it in a sense that we also expect in exchange, we expect a taste from our service, and we expect certain conditions in a way to serve?
We do, but that's not pure devotional service, as in the last verse in Shikshastakam, Ashvishava Padavatam Panastaman. You can be very unfaithful to me and break my heart, not come before me, whatever you like. I'm still your devotee. You're my Lord unconditionally. So, in that verse, Lord Chaitanya, speaking in the mood of Srimati Radharani, doesn't have any condition. You just be who you are. I'm your servant, and I will render you loving service. So, but Krishna is not like a erratic, unknown person. Coming down the information about bhakti from all the great devotees and all the texts is that he's actually controlled by bhakti, and so we can be sure that if we do, and he himself says, if you offer me with devotion a fruit or a leaf, water, I will accept it. If you remember me, you will come back to me. So we have expectations based on Krishna's own promises to us. But we should allow him his independence to reciprocate with us in or not, at any particular stage, that now I'm chanting Hare Krishna, you should appear before me, or I must have tears of love right away. We know that if he doesn't reciprocate according to our calculations and expectations right away, it's that we're not ripe yet, we're not ready for the kind of reciprocation you would like to have. But when you get ready, by patient execution of service, then Krishna will reciprocate, just as he says in the scriptures, if you think of me, and I'll be there, and so on. I don't know if I've answered your question. It's a deep question. All right, we'll go on to the next one. 30. janma karma cha vishmatman ajasya katuratmana tiryan visheshu yadasu tadadyanta vidambanam. Again, vidambanam. Oh, of course it is bewildering, O soul of the universe, that you work though you are inactive, and that you take birth though you are the vital force and the unborn. You yourself descend among animals, men, sages, and aquatics. Verily, this is bewildering. So now here are, before she introduced the principle of bewildering, and now there are some examples, and the next verse will be a very striking example. But now there are some sort of categorical examples of the apparently contradictory nature and behavior of Krishna. And the main point is that he is inconceivable, and he definitely can do whatever he wants. That like solves it in general. And I'm going to ask you actually to solve these riddles, but the general solution is that he can do whatever he likes because he's inconceivable. Inconceivable to our limited power, like the question of how could a man marry 16,000 wives? It's not possible, we think. But he can do things, he makes the impossible possible. So then, from what you know, either of this purport or Krishna's pastimes, how would you explain this bewildering point here, that Krishna is inactive and yet he takes birth? Someone say, how is that? That the inactive. What? I'm sorry. Soul of the universe. You work though you are inactive. Someone? Yes. Yeah. The word is karma. And so that we know janma karma cha me divyam. He has karma. Krishna, it's called Krishna karma. Krishna activities. And they don't have any material karma. So that's, yeah, you've given the answer. It's not that Krishna is inactive like a blob or a light. And that's the only way he can be free of the modes. But he has Krishna karma. All right. You work though you are inactive. You take birth though you are the vital force and the unborn. How can Krishna be the son of some mother and father if he's the unborn? Yes. Creates himself. That's right. Yeah, but you can't say he creates himself. He's always existing. Yeah, you can ask a question. Somebody can ask a question like that. Well, who created God? Or where did God get his knowledge? But the nature of God is that he is uncreated, and he's independent in terms of his knowledge and so on. So, someone else, let's answer that again, though. How he can be take birth of a mother and father, but be unborn. Yes.
So he's fully present as the baby. It's not like he's put into a baby.
He's already existing. Yeah. And it says having a mother and father is just his leela for those devotees. Yes? He's not only born one time like we were, you know, March 1952 or something, but he's always appearing in all the different universes. There's so many differences between the appearance of Krishna and our appearance. And you descend among animals, men, sages, and aquatics. He takes all these different forms that are bewildering, a fish, a hog, a sage, a man. So these pastimes are bewildering. I'm going to turn to a very similar couple of verses on this topic, spoken in the third canto by Uddhava, about the bewildering nature of Krishna's pastime. The word vidambanam is used there also. When Uddhava was explaining to Bhadura about Krishna, it's called the Remembrance of Lord Krishna, chapter 3, canto 3, chapter 2. In verse 16, Uddhava says, "When I think of Lord Krishna, how he was born in the prison house of Vasudeva, although he is unborn, how he went away from his father's protection to Braja and lived there incognito out of fear of the enemy, and how, although unlimitedly powerful, he fled from Mathura in fear, all these bewildering incidents give me distress." Prabhupada in the purport explains it one way and says that Krishna is playing the part so expertly. He plays the part of a child, for example, and he plays the part so well that you get bewildered and you think that he's not God. But if he's going to come as a child, he'll really do it. And so it says even pure devotees like Uddhava are bewildered, especially the devotees who are fixed in the Aishvarya, the majestic aspect of Krishna, and sometimes get bewildered or astonished. Then Prabhupada says, "Because the Lord is all-powerful, it is possible for him to adjust opposites, such as birth and no birth, power and defeat, fear and fearlessness. A pure devotee knows very well how it is possible for the Lord to adjust opposite things, but he laments for the non-devotees who, not knowing the supreme glories of the Lord, think of him as imaginary, simply because there are so many apparently contradictory statements in the scriptures." So the bewilderment in this case, the pure devotee is saying, it's not bewildering for the Lord, and it's not bewildering for me, actually, but I know that, my Lord, your pastimes are so fantastic that the non-devotees are, they can't accept you. So I'm sorry about that. But what can you expect, that Krishna is going to have some ordinary activities? So that people will accept, yes, he's a nice God. He doesn't do these things that are so hard to understand, marry 16,000 wives and steal the butter and all these things. But he is who he is, and we have to accept him as he is and learn how he's all attractive in his apparently contradictory, bewildering activities. Then Uddhava says, talking about those people who blaspheme and criticize Krishna, even in India they do that. Sometimes they say, we like Lord Rama. He has one wife and he has very regulated activities. But Lord Krishna goes with the gopis and he does all these activities. He appears to be immoral. So people talk like that, and the devotees sometimes have to hear this. "Under no circumstances can the words of persons bewildered by the illusory energy of the Lord deviate the intelligence of those who are completely surrendered souls." He's talking, for example, of the disappearance of the Lord. There's a lot of false propaganda about how Krishna was killed by a hunter and he had to suffer sinful reactions. So we hear these things, but we're not affected if we're fixed devotees. "All these blasphemies do not touch the heart of the devotees of the Lord, because they know perfectly well what is what. Their intelligence regarding the Lord is never disturbed, but those who are disturbed by the statements of the asuras are also condemned." This is what Uddhava meant. So if a devotee hears about some propaganda that Krishna is contradictory and so on, and he gets affected, then he joins the bewildered ranks. He should not get disturbed. Any questions in this verse 30? Yeah. It's in the 11th canto or 12th canto. The arrow hit the ground. Yeah. That's in Vishnu Chakravarti's commentary, but not in the verse, I don't think. Certain things Vishnu Chakravarti simply won't accept, even if they appear to be in the verse. He didn't like that Krishna was hitting it. He said it hit the ground. but yeah, it was not that he was an ordinary man. He was hit and he died. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking that I want to be real precise on that. I was trying to make a promise to myself to read that. All the details are not fresh in my mind. I'd like to be able to be real precise. because you get asked it a lot.
The story that you hear sometimes is that he left the body behind for the atheists.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have, you know, they'd be able to criticize.
Uh-huh, yeah. And that pastime can bewilder them so that they can say that. Yeah. Okay. Now we're on 31. This we have to chant, like the Brahma Samhita. Gopya dade twayi krita gasi dhammatavad Yate dashashru kalilanjana sambramaksham vatram niniya bhaya bhavanayasti tasya samam vimohayatibir apiyad vibheti. My dear Lord, my dear Krishna, Yasoda took up a rope to bind you when you committed an offense, and your perturbed eyes overflooded with tears, which washed the mascara from your eyes, and you were afraid. Although fear personified is afraid of you, this sight is bewildering to me. Now I have a specific example of bewilderment. And Prabhupada explains, this is yoga maya. There's another way to understand Krishna's activities, that he would appear to be a child afraid of his mother, although fear personified, death is afraid of him. This kind of rasa where Krishna becomes subordinate to the devotees, even chastised and rebuked, he likes these pastimes even better than he likes when he's approached as time, as a supreme controller, with awe and reverence. So this is certainly one of the best examples of being such a helpless child, a naughty child, who misbehaves. The mother chases him, catches him, and is about to punish him. And then he becomes so afraid he starts to cry. And Prabhupada gave one explanation, it's like almost sounds like modern psychology. He also said that when Mother Yasoda saw that he was so afraid, then she said, he'll get a bad impression. Prabhupada said, this is psychology. That if the child becomes too frightened, it will make a bad impression on him. Yeah. So she was afraid that I'm scaring him so much that I don't want to do this. And so great was the yoga maya that she thought Krishna was really having a trauma. So how could this be that the Supreme Personality of Godhead gets so afraid of his mother? I have a nice excerpt of Prabhupada.
Jati dasha. Dasha. When as soon as Krishna saw Mother Yashoda is coming with a rope to bind him, so he immediately became very much afraid, so that tears came out. Mother is coming to bind. Jati dasha kalila. Anjana. And the ointment is being washed off. Sambhrama, and with great respect looking to the mother, with feeling appeal, yes, mother, I have offended you, kindly excuse me. This was the scene of Krishna. So that scene is appreciated by Kunti. And immediately, head became downward. So this is another Krishna's perfection, that although he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Bhagavad Gita he says, matta parataram nanyat, kinchi dasti dhananyat. My dear Arjun, there is no superior being above me. I am the supermost. Natya, matya, parataram, anyat. There is nobody else. That Supreme Personality of Godhead, above whom there is none. That Supreme Personality of Godhead is bowing down before Mother Yashoda. Niniyam, bhaktram niniyam. He is accepting, my dear mother, yes, I am offended.
Prabhupada takes the opportunity to discuss more about Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan and the special feature. And later he tells us that this is not Queen Kunti's relationship. She's a devotee of Hastinapur, but she's very much appreciating how Krishna is in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada talks about other Vrindavan pastimes and the nature of that relationship, which is different than all other devotees of the Lord. He talks about the cowherd boys and killing of demons, what it's like there every day. The boys come home and say to their mothers, "Mother, Krishna is so wonderful." And they would explain what had happened that day. And the mothers would say, "Yes, our Krishna is wonderful." They did not know that Krishna is God, the Supreme Person. They only knew that Krishna is wonderful, that's all. And the more they perceived Krishna's wonderful activities, the more their love increased. Perhaps he may be a demigod, they thought. When Nanda Maharaj, Krishna's father, talked among his friends, the friends would talk about Krishna and say, "Oh, Nanda Maharaj, your child Krishna is wonderful." And Nanda Maharaj would respond, "Yes, I see that. Maybe he is some demigod." And even that was not certain, but maybe. Thus the inhabitants of Vrindavan do not care who is God and who is not. They love Krishna, that's all. Those who think of first analyzing Krishna to determine whether he is God are not first-class devotees. The first-class devotees are those who have spontaneous love for Krishna. How can we analyze Krishna? He is unlimited, and therefore it is impossible. There's another example in Chaitanya Charitamrita of this contrast where Balabhabhata, he came to Lord Chaitanya and said that I've been writing an essay about the different names of Krishna, and I've analyzed him by his names in many, many ways. And he wanted some praise for that. But Lord Chaitanya, knowing this, said, No, I only know two or three names of Krishna, that's all. And he gave some names like son of Yasoda, emphasizing this, analysis of Krishna is not the mood of the Brijabasis, who simply love Krishna, and their analysis is, maybe he's a demigod. Maybe. We have limited perception, and our senses have limited potency. So how can we study Krishna? It is not possible at all. Krishna reveals himself to a certain extent, and that much is sufficient. So we should stress loving service to Krishna more than analysis, although of course we need the Krishna tattva. But whatever wherever we're given in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, as much as we can understand, we're satisfied. Not that we always have to demand, how can he be God, how can this, how can this, otherwise we will not be pleasing to Krishna. So it's interesting that Queen Kunti is not in this mood, and yet she appreciates the mood so much. Prabhupada talks about that. He says, Kunti Devi was not an inhabitant of Vrindavan. She was an inhabitant of Hastinapur, which is outside Vrindavan. The devotees outside Vrindavan study how great the inhabitants of Vrindavan are, but the inhabitants of Vrindavan don't care to know how great Krishna is. That is the difference between them. So our concern should be simply to love Krishna. The more we love Krishna, the more we shall become perfect. It is not necessary to understand Krishna and how he creates. He explains himself in Bhagavad Gita. We should not try to understand much more. We should not bother very much to know Krishna. That is not possible. We should simply increase our unalloyed love for Krishna. This is the perfection of life. So we can do that by Prabhupada's grace through deity worship, through all kinds of service in ISKCON, helping devotees, and chanting the holy name. These are not in themselves like just cognitive approaches. And even when we study, what do we study? We study nectar devotion. We study Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, above jnana is bhakti, surrender to me. We study bhakti, and we study Krishna book, and we study Srimad Bhagavatam. So even our study is not to try to know Krishna, but to try to love him. And a symptom, Prabhupada said, of our advancement is that we are growing in liking to hear. If there's a kirtan or time to chant or time to hear about Krishna, we like to hear. Not that we are coming to the stage where we think we know everything about Krishna, but we like to hear about him more and more. This is bhakti. Yes,
Is it a valid ambition to want to know more about Krishna, to preach on his behalf?
Yeah, that would be like the sentiment would be, I want to be a good preacher and represent Krishna and Prabhupada and make people become devotees. As long as it's not like just to be a jnani and to impress people that I know so many things, I can quote so many shlokas, my logical arguments are unbeatable. But actually, I need to have that because I meet people and they make arguments and I want to be able to defeat them, so equip myself with the shlokas and with the arguments so I can melt people's hearts and and bring them to Krishna. Well, that's like Prabhupada. He was so well equipped to preach. But when we think of what it was that in Prabhupada that won people over, there was no lack of scholarship, but there was that something special, that bhakti that would go right to their hearts, and people would think, "Wow, Krishna is real. I want to become a devotee." And Prabhupada would say, "It is such a nice thing." Yes, it's valid to want to. That's why we have the Gitanagar Institute and VIHE, want to study. And we have intellect. We're all to some degree intellectual, especially in this age. So there's a demand for argument and analysis. We have to satisfy that part of ourself. Often people say, one devotee was saying to me just yesterday that I was raised as a Catholic, he said, and so much we were told, it's a mystery, you can't understand it, you just have to accept. He said, I just don't like that, I can't stand that. I will have to have answers. So we have answers for that intellect demand. But ultimately, it's really not as important as loving Krishna. I heard Prabhupada once say, philosophy is for the atheists, meaning that we learn philosophy for the benefit of the atheists, for to defeat the atheists. That's why we need it. But otherwise, we can just chant Hare Krishna. But there are atheists. We do have a preaching mission, so we must have all this equipment. Bhaktivedanta Institute. So many arguments against the puffed up atheist. But to love Krishna, you don't need all those proofs and arguments. Proofs in the fossil record, or proofs of the invalidity of Darwin's theory. But for preaching, you must have it.
Yeah. I'm not trying to be argumentative, but just to get closer to the theme of loving Krishna in a practical, in other words, acquiring knowledge to preach to atheists and even to devotees, who may be partially atheists, isn't it a manifestation, or could you say it's a manifestation of love? In other words, the mood of retiring to Vrindavan to chant nicely, to love Krishna, or, you know, like Prabhupada's kind, he did both, of course, he was expert in this.
Yeah, so I said that it's a manifestation of our love to be sharp with all our arguments. I was just reading a letter Prabhupada wrote to Hridayananda Maharaj and I when we were traveling and preaching. He was telling all different things we should do, and he said, and if you write every day, your language will be sharp, you'll be able to speak well, and you should dress neatly, and you should do this, and you should do that. So one wants to do all these things, especially get knowledge. I always said, and you should always quote our Sanskrit authorities, this will be very impressive, and study the books. That if I can become equipped, then it's love. If it can be love, and it should be love, to serve the acharya and to be a good preacher on his behalf.
Bhakti Vedanta.
Yeah, Bhakti Vedanta. So it doesn't hurt that thrust to say that that for pleasing Krishna, He's pleased by the devotion that's within that, more than that you became such a formidable scholar. What's that to him? But that you were so devoted that you learned the philosophy and you always want to preach whenever there's an opportunity. Why do you want to preach? Because you love Krishna and you love Prabhupada and you want to serve him. That's what is appealing to him. And he may see that same love expressed in other ways. Yeah, well, certainly we have so many books. Prabhupada would say, just chant Hare Krishna, that's all you have to do. But if you want to be convinced, we have 60 volumes, so many books, come on. Be convinced by reason and argument. But it's all bhakti. It's not that we think after a while I'll give up studying the philosophy or speaking the philosophy. And I need the philosophy. As you say, the devotee, the conditioned devotee, he's a bit of an agnostic. And in this age, he's surrounded by agnosticism. So we don't want to be like that, that suddenly we meet somebody, we meet a Christian, or we meet a scientist, and he says something to us, and we become like Uddhava's mentioned here. We become bewildered. Oh, I can't answer that question. Maybe that's true. He said that. But no, we're so fixed, so we need the philosophy for our devotion, keep our devotion strong, not just a sentiment. It's so nice the way it comes together, bhakti and Vedanta. Okay, here's my time. Thank you.